Good afternoon. The meeting will come to order. Clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum. We have the minutes before us of the April 14th meeting and the April 13th meeting. Are there any corrections, additions, or changes to the minutes? Representative Carlson moves approval of the April 13th and 14th minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes being approved, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. A couple things. Firstly, House File 890 will be the first bill on the agenda to accommodate a scheduling issue. House File 890 will be up first. Secondly, the bill that was scheduled to be last, House File 2135, the lottery issue involving the White Earth and Red Lake Tribe, has been pulled from the agenda. There is a tax issue that is coming forward that may necessitate the bill going to the tax committee, and so we are not going to be taking up that bill today. So if you are here waiting for that, that bill is not going to be taken up today. For the other bills that are on the agenda, if anyone has testimony they wish to give, I would ask that you see Eric Anderson, our page, who is the gentleman in the blue shirt, standing up and waving his hand there. With that, any questions before we get started on House File 890? Seeing none. Representative Smith moves that House File 890 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Smith, can you explain House File 890?
Chairman of the committee, yes. I have with me Mr. Larry Martin, Executive Director of the Pension Commission, and I'm going to ask him to describe the bill. But briefly, the bill would require the large public pension funds to jointly retain a consulting actuary. In the past, the Pension Commission has directly hired the consulting actuary. This bill will change that, and I'd ask Mr. Martin to be a little more specific.
Mr. Martin, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Member. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Larry Martin from the staff of the Pension Commission. House File 890 changes the way in which the official actuarial work for the various Minnesota public pension plans will be handled. It changes the entity that retains the consulting actuary from the Pension Commission to to the various pension funds acting jointly. The bill is really a result of difficulties in trying to accommodate concerns from the current actuary retained by the Pension Commission, and apparently a growing trend in the actuarial field, a concern about liability issues and concerns about or demands for limitations on actuarial liabilities. The Pension Commission is not in a good position to bargain these concerns out. The pension funds, because they retain individual actuaries and can rearrange the way that actuarial services are performed, are in a better opposition to resolve these concerns. So the commission worked on the issue during the end of the interim and the start of the session, concluded that the best way to handle the circumstances to divest the Pension Commission from the obligation of retaining the official state actuary and changing it to the pension plans. The change also modifies somewhat or resolves somewhat the issue of trying to budget for actuarial services. The current budget for actuarial services varies on a four-year pattern rather than a two-year biennial pattern, with the preparation of quadrennial experience studies every 4 years, and makes it very, very difficult to budget. Since the Pension Commission currently bills back the cost of this function to the pension funds, giving it to the various pension funds would allow them to better budget for the varying costs for the actuarial services program. There is a fiscal note, members. It shows a $162,000 reduction in the recouping back of money from the various public employee pension plans. as part of Representative Haas's state government bill, the Pension Commission's budget would be reduced by $152,000 to offset most of that cost, the differential being a small budget for actuarial services if the legislature, rather than the pension plans, have need to prepare actuarial work.
Discussion to the bill. Any discussion to the bill? Seeing no discussion, Representative Smith renews his motion that House File 890 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next bill will be House File 2175. And members, you may recall you have seen this bill before. This bill was actually passed by this committee last week. And after we got the bill and were preparing the report, we realized that there was some appropriation language that should have been put into the bill that was not put into the bill. And so I held the bill instead of sending it to the floor with the idea that we could go ahead and deal with that issue here. And so, members, what I'd like to do at this time is move that the vote by which House File 2175 was recommended to pass be now reconsidered. Any discussion? All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is now reconsidered. Okay, we have House File 2175 before us. Chair will move House File 2175 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. And I will also move the A18 amendment, which should be in your packets. And Representative Abler, I'm sure you didn't expect to see us this soon, but welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chair, it's always good to be here, and I'm glad for the chance to have some more detail discussed about this bill. There's 10 articles of licensure matters which are germane to very small groups of people, but for today, if you like, we can just talk about the amendment, which and we discussed in some length the malpractice topic, and upon further review, that thing might need some more work, and so the amendment includes the appropriation as well as the deletion of that particular paragraph. So I think it's a problem that needs to be addressed, but not this year.
And members, I want to be clear on this, that the A18 amendment really has two parts. The first is the appropriation language that I referenced, which we did not put into the bill last time and needed to be put in. The second is we had a discussion for those members that were here last time on page 57 about the medical malpractice language. And Representative Haas had moved to take that out. We had had a discussion about it. Representative Haas had then withdrawn his motion. We then passed it. Members, I'm proposing as part of this amendment to delete that language. And Representative Abler, maybe I can have you speak a little bit more to that issue.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, it's actually dental malpractice.
Dental malpractice, me.
And the discussion had to do with how would they implement it, and I think the situation presents itself is that in the world of dentistry, more patients pay cash for a higher percentage of their services for dental services than that's true of medical or other kinds of professional care. And so the issue had to do with some dentists that had some quality control issues that had gone bankrupt, and so there's nowhere to go to get the remedy over the tens of thousands of dollars of services for these implants and others. And the remedy was thought to be if they had malpractice, they could then get that damages, which I like the idea of that. There's some implementation issues that have come up, and the parties that agreed are now not quite in agreement. So it's better to be an interim project, and so I think the deletion is reasonable. The problem will be addressed, I suppose, next year. So.
Representative Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Abler, do I have to take back all that nice stuff I said about how you brought people together and stuff then if they've all fallen apart in the ensuing week?
Representative Abler. Kelleher,
sometimes the deal is, as you sign the deal as they come and then they... no, please don't take it back.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, in all seriousness, Representative Abler, the folks who were in agreement are now out of alignment, and we have some problems. So this is – does anyone still support going forward with the language?
Representative Abler.
Other than maybe
Kelleher,
you?
I like it.
Yeah.
Actually, just to be totally clear, the board still is very strongly in favor of it. I think the citizenry would favor this. I think in terms of how it's implemented with the professional association and what an ALJ require that there be a number. That's the issue is how do they say what's coverage? If you have a $5 policy, now you have coverage. And so I think at the end of the day, next year, we'll have to come forward with some level of coverage that they'll agree to. And they never got into the discussion about level of coverage. I think the conceptual agreement is there, but now we've got the details, and you know who's in those. So thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelleher.
You know, I'm still an optimist, and I think we might be out of here by May 17th. I hear other people say other things. Is there not enough time to work this out in between it passing this committee and moving on?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
I think that that's not impossible. Certainly by the second special session, I think we can get an agreement. So, thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I actually had a question that was just answered, but your concluding comment raised another question, and if there's still time as this bill moves forward for the agreement to be worked out, what's the status of this language in the Senate and with the House and Senate rules about new issues being inserted in conference committee, wouldn't you be better off with some language in the bill to keep the discussion alive and then hopefully working it out so that consumers are protected?
Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, it's a valid point. Actually, the Senate language is like this. It would be my recommendation, given the current level of agreement, that the House language be the language to go forward out of the conference committee in the event that an agreement could be crafted, and I'm not sure that there's time to actually discuss the nuances of what number makes the most sense for level of coverage. That would be, I think, a germane topic inserted just as a sentence in this similar language in the Senate if that agreement could be reached. I think at this point, I'm not real optimistic about that. So that's my the House position at this point, I think, will prevail, which would be no language on that topic.
Members, I've just been alerted by counsel that there's an additional technical amendment I need to incorporate it into this amendment, and that would be page 58, lines 2 and 6, reinstate the stricken language and delete the new language. That's just simply a numbering issue in terms of some paragraphs, so I would incorporate that into the amendment. Other discussion to the A18 amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the A18 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A18 amendment is adopted. Discussion to the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I had a couple dentists that were concerned about some of the provisions that were in. I don't know if it's this bill that you were carrying or another bill on dentistry. Is there anything that increases the requirements for your education, you know, the requirements that you have to keep your license and you have to have so many credits?
Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, rather than me answering, and I would be happy to, I'll let the board answer that so you can get the precise answer you want.
Mr. Schrag, welcome to the back to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Marshall Schrag, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Dentistry. Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, the issue that you're addressing actually is in proposed rules, which have gone through part of the rulemaking process, and we've had published and received the 60-day period of comments. We've had approval from the governor's office, and May 10th, I believe, we'll be publishing the board's intent to adopt, which is another 30-day comment period, which most likely will be followed by public hearings.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
So, Mr. Schrag, and I think you had another bill that was moving on its own, or was it this bill here? That dealt with, education requirements for dentists. Is this the only? So that's then.
We've got this bill, which has to do with licensure issues, Representative Rukavina, and then we also have, in a parallel plane, we've got the rulemaking process going on that has to do with the professional development.
Okay. Well, then, Mr. Chair,
Representative Rukavina,
I won't worry about it here. But Mr. Schrag, I do have, dentists who are concerned. We've had a hard time replacing dentists, especially most of whom are homegrown up in our area, and with the limits on the dentistry school at the university and the number of people that are allowed to apply every year, you know, to make them take more credits than what they're already required. I believe you were going to a two-year period of about doubling. I have some concerns about that that I would like to talk to you about, your convenience.
I'd welcome that discussion. Thank you.
Other discussion. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Abler, I'm looking on page 69 of your bill, and I'm noticing that you are encouraging health care providers to use mercury-free vaccines when available, and that seems like an appropriate standard for adults, but an incredibly weak standard for children. Is there a reason for that?
Representative Wagenius, Representative Abler.
Thank you. We're almost like twins. So. Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, actually, I personally agree. This amendment, this section of the bill was was on the calendar as a bill last year, and it was just in a way to increase communications with the people that had varying views on vaccines, and it was maybe controversial, certainly, and this was the agreed on terminology that would go forward. I personally have a great concern about Chimerosal. And children in particular, and we were told by the department that they're working on this anyway. And so if it's compromise language, the crafted agreement was that they would continue to phase away from that, short of a prohibition, and that they would encourage, especially the children, to be getting the Chimerosal free. The problem actually was a rural one more than a metro one, because they would a clinic would buy a batch of something, since they immunized only a very few kids, that it would actually go bad too soon, so they couldn't stock the other, the better kind. But in the metro area, it was hardly an issue at all, because they would have a larger volume. That's at least what Dr. Hull told us. And so the industry is moving away from Chimerosal. Representative Boudreau, she's on this committee, who had a part in that discussion as well. So.
Representative Wagenius. And Representative Wagenius, could you use your mic? I'm having a little hard time hearing you.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm on page 69, lines 3 and 4, looking at the standard for vaccine use when it contains mercury, and feeling that that's probably a fine standard here for adults, but it implies that for the convenience of adults, it's okay to give kids mercury. I don't think that is... Knowing you, I don't think that is the standard that you would go along with. And it seems to me that we should separate out, and I hope you would do that, the difference between adults and children here. Because to say that we're phasing it out, well, we're phasing it out because we know it's bad for kids. But if we know it's bad for kids, then why are some children getting the vaccine? I mean, a child only has one early childhood. And if they're impacted, then they're impacted. Maybe 10 years from now, children won't be impacted, but that same child will be impacted. I just think that this gives the wholly wrong message to say we'll encourage phasing it out when available. Who are we protecting here? I'm really perturbed about this particular sentence in your bill.
Representative Abler.
Representative Wagenius, to me, I perceive it as a step in the direction that I would prefer to have a prohibition. That wasn't going to prevail. And so I am moving the ball forward as far as it can go on this topic. If you look at this section as a whole, what it creates is a dialogue amongst the people that have concerns and those who do not. Historically, they have not even talked. And so it's meant to be an agreed-upon, moving the right direction piece of language. It's not groundbreaking, but it goes a good way. I think had there been a realistic chance of getting a prohibition, I would have personally preferred that, but I don't think that's realistic at this point. This language was agreed upon by the Department of Health and the advocates who are represented here in this these six list of six people on the line, page 69. I think for today it's reasonable. I think as a goal for the future, more is a good idea. Realistically, that's the best I could do. So I'm glad to have you on board and in being concerned, but.
Representative Ugnius.
Mr. Chairman, it's not a matter of being on board. When there is such question about something and that it can harm children, it seems to me that we should do more than do what's convenient for providers. Because any child who's damaged now will have that damage for the rest of So why are we almost putting our stamp of approval and saying, okay, we think you kids, you know, we haven't gotten around to it, but we think you kids, and your rural kids after all, I mean, I don't know why rural members aren't standing on their desks right now. If I were a rural legislator, I'd be standing on my desk. Because this is not protected of rural children.
Representative Huntley?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Ugnius said, why would we get something we know is bad for kids to kids? And we don't know that it's bad for kids. The scientific evidence, as reviewed by, I can't remember if it's the National Institutes of Health or the FDA or Institute of Medicine just about a month and a half ago, looked at this very issue and concluded that there was no evidence that thimerosal in vaccines was bad for kids. Granted, we just as soon not use it, but if that's the only vaccine that's available to those kids, they're much better off getting that vaccine and not getting the disease that that vaccine will prevent. So to say that we know it's bad for kids is not true.
Representative Ugnius.
I will take that back and say we don't know that it's okay for kids either. That's the problem. So when you are in the position of not knowing, and so many questions have been raised, then it seems to me you want to, if you're going to err, you're going to err on the side of protecting the children. So, yes, it hasn't been proven, and I agree with that, but I don't like the idea of experimenting on children at all. And that is what we are almost being reduced to, which I don't like. So we just
Representative Huntley.
Just to respond, first of all, I suppose the experiment would be not to give kids vaccines and see what that result would be. The best evidence today is that kids should get these vaccines. If we can get rid of thimerosal, fine, but if that's what's available, that's what we ought to use. And there's all kinds of evidence to show that there is no relationship between thimerosal or mercury in vaccines and the host of childhood problems that are supposed to have been related to it. All the statistics and all the evidence, not all, but the vast majority of it goes the other way and says that it is safe.
Representative Earhart, do you want to get on this too?
Well, I just have a question, Mr. Chairman, and that is, does that old reliable spot, the Health Department website, have anything on it about this issue?
Representative Earhart, I'm sorry I asked. Representative Ugnius.
Okay, well, just so we can keep our facts straight here, my grandchildren who live in the suburbs of Chicago can get all of their vaccines without thimerosal in it. And if they can get it that way, then why can't all children in Minnesota get it? So it's not to say whether they should be vaccinated or not. I totally agree that they should be vaccinated. It's just what's the preservative in the vaccine. And when we have measured thimerosal against some of the things like autism, maybe we don't see a statistical significance. However, we know that mercury has the same effect as lead, and over the long term, I think that our caution should be with the children and not with the providers.
Representative Abler?
Well, Mr. Chair, I agree with actually Representative Wagenius, but I just to encourage you about what this will do. If this establishes at least a cautionary note, which as you can tell is, even at that, it was somewhat controversial. I'm not sure about the website or not, but I see that this will have an effect of reducing some kids' exposure. I see that as a positive step. So if I save half the kids, then we've saved half the kids from potential harm, and I think that's a reasonable step for today. And that's, I think, the best that can be done today. I think if you go with the prohibition, the whole part of the bill might go out, and you'll have nothing to show for your effort, and no kids will be spared. So I'm hoping to keep the language that's here for today and continue the dialogue, and I appreciate the members' interest in this bill. And there's a few more sections you haven't talked about yet, Mr. Chair.
Any other discussion to the bill? Seeing no further discussion, the Chair renews his motion that House File 2175, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Abler.
All right.
Okay. Next, we'll take up House File 2127, Representative Boudreau. The Chair will move House File 2127 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Welcome to the committee, Representative Boudreau.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I know you don't usually do policy issues, but I do have a couple of amendments. And the reason for those amendments, one is a new development, and another amendment deals with the fiscal note. Let's take up.
Why don't we take the A8 amendment first?
Please.
Chair, I'll move the A8 amendment, which I think is mostly technical. But Representative Boudreau, can you tell us about the A8 amendment?
Mr. Chairman, the A8 amendment simply states that unless the commissioner has secured funds from non-state sources, in other words, private funds, the adverse reporting event component of the bill would not be implemented. So it just allows for the year 2005 non-state sources to be used to implement that. And it would then eliminate the fiscal note for $38,000.
I don't know if I should have necessarily said that's technical members, but it's maybe clarifying. Any discussion to the A8 amendment? Representatives... All right, we'll call on Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, does this then take any of the obligation and put it into the next biennium? Is that what you're doing?
Representative Boudreau.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, yes. This eliminates the state's obligation in the implementation of this particular system, which reports adverse events. It's something that we did implement last year for hospitals. This would be continued with, as I explained the bill, once getting ahead of ourselves, Mr. Chairman, but it does allow for an adverse event reporting system to be implemented with the outpatient clinic as well. And it just says private sources would be used.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, I've received, probably as everyone has, some questions on both sides of this bill. It's not without some adversaries on both sides of the issue. And I want to know, does this change then the ability of a standalone clinic to be able to have some redress to its adversarial type of procedure? I was under the understanding that some of the controversy was taken out of the bill with being able to apply, and it seems like we may be delaying this.
Representative Boudreau.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to that inquiry, thank you, Representative Solberg, for asking. I do have a couple of handouts from the entities that have been engaged in this discussion. And yes, you are absolutely right. When this bill was first introduced, because it deals with outpatient surgery clinics and imaging centers, there was considerable controversy. But it is something that has been worked out. There's a compromise, and that is before you. And I'm just pleased that the parties were able to work this out. And please, those handouts will indicate that fact, that this is, at this point, I do not know of anyone that has any opposition to the particular proposal. If there are, it's something new today.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, my question is, I understood that the compromise had been worked out before, but I thought part of that compromise, and I may be mistaken, was to be able to have this takeoff program that you're delaying for into the next fiscal year. Is that still part of the compromise, or does that delay request coming from them, or where does the request for the delay of implementing the program come from into the next biennium?
Welcome to the committee, sir. Could you state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is David Feinwax. I am general counsel for the Minnesota Hospital Association, and perhaps I can add some clarification to this. The adverse event amendment that is before you now is something that this legislature enacted last year, and it requires adverse events to be reported by hospitals. As part of the compromise on these ambulatory surgery centers and diagnostic imaging facilities, we all agreed that these types of adverse events should be reported to the state if they occur there as well. All of the funding for this program is voluntary. We are fundraising for this, and we have provided the Minnesota Department of Health with funds. There are no state funds involved. This amendment makes it clear that the outpatient portion of this program, just as the hospital portion was, will not be implemented until we have privately raised the funds to make it run so that the state doesn't have to pay for it.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Okay. And so, just so I understand, Representative Boudreau, so this, in terms of the private funds, though, these are still coming from the same sources in terms of fees and such as was contemplated before, correct?
Mr. Chairman, this is not about fees. This is about voluntary contributions by private sources to assure that the system would be implemented. And I would assume that the hospitals have acquired some means of collecting those revenues.
Okay. Representative Solberg?
Well, Mr. Chairman, what happens if they don't do that? Does it fall back to the state in the next biennium?
Representative Boudreau.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, it simply isn't effective. The whole section is not effective. On page 11, as the amendment modifies the language, it would simply say this section is effective on the date of full implementation of the adverse health care events reporting system as provided in laws, etc., provided, then you go to this language, provided the commissioner has secured sufficient funds from non-state sources to operate the reporting system in fiscal year 2005. Okay. So I hope that's clarifying.
And maybe we should do, Representative Boudreau, since there are questions about the bills. Before we act on this amendment, why don't you give us the review of the bill now? I thought the amendment would be non-controversial, but maybe we're better if we just review the bill now and then we'll go to the amendment.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I do believe the amendment is non-controversial, and I think the whole thing is non-controversial because we took all the controversy out of it. Key provisions of the bill are that surgery centers would be licensed in statute rather than in rules as they are today. Physicians would be required to inform patients of their ownership interest in surgery centers or the imaging facilities when referring patients. Imaging facilities would be required to report information that we just talked about, similar to what hospitals and surgery centers are already required to report. That information does also include ownership interest, patient payer mix, and utilization numbers. The Minnesota Nurses Association, as well as the Minnesota Medical Association and the Minnesota Hospital Association, have worked very diligently together to come up with language that all three entities are now supportive of. Not just not opposed, they are supportive. And I would ask that the committee honor that compromise.
Okay, Representative Solberg.
I think you can go to the amendment. I'm comfortable with it.
All right. Okay, and let me say it, because I know this was a bill that had controversy, and now there are amendments coming forward. I guess I would repeat that if there's someone from any of the various interests that are affected by this that have an issue with any of the amendments that are proposed or the bill, I certainly would again invite them to come forward and testify. With that, any other discussion to the A8 amendment? See no discussion. All in favor of the A8 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A8 amendment is adopted. All right, Representative Boudreau. Next we have the A9 amendment. And the chair will move the A9 amendment. Representative Boudreau, can you tell us about the A9 amendment?
Mr. Chairman, again, I apologize for bringing an amendment so late, but the issue was just proposed to me today. Apparently there was some request or concern expressed by the Department of Health in regard to whether or not they would need to implement some kind of how they would implement the changes. And so I do have folks here that I think should probably relate how this came about. But this simply is clarifying language as to how the information that is reported is collected. And perhaps Mr. Feinwax, again, should give you some verification of what took place today.
Mr. Feinwax, can you tell us about the A9 amendment?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, members, the A9 amendment came to us from the Minnesota Department of Health, who expressed concern that it would be their preference that the specific data elements that we all agree should be reported be actually enumerated and listed in the legislation to avoid any possibility that they would have to engage in rulemaking. This also, you know, eliminated any possible fiscal impact. We have worked with them in crafting this amendment. Mr. Lights from the department is seated there, and I think he's nodding his head. They're comfortable. We're all comfortable. And once again, it eliminates any possible fiscal note.
Okay. Any other discussion to the amendment? Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, in reading the line 5, 4 and 5, where it says including workers' compensation, is that listed separately? Or is each category listed separated in the data that's collected? Or is it combined for everything?
No? Mr. Chairman,
we have someone coming forward.
I think the department should speak to that.
Be happy to have
question.
Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Lights. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health. Mr. Chair, Representative, your question was as to the workers' compensation portion of this of the language here.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I noticed on line 4 and 5, you're delineating for each health plan company, so statistics for that, each public program, statistics for that, and then workers' compensation is issued separately. Are you gathering individual, or are you just having all the data mixed together and sent in?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I believe the intent here is to have workers' compensation as a separate public program category. So, for example, we would be collecting information on the number of, CT procedures performed for medical assistance fee for service, for PMAP, and then also for workers' compensation.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Solberg,
can you give me the reason why you would separate things out like that?
Mr. Lightsey?
Maybe there's a valid reason.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my understanding is that the parties who were involved in negotiations on what was to be collected here had an interest in collecting that information separately for each of those categories.
And I guess, being this is again something new, if there's someone here from the imaging centers that represents them that wants to speak on this, I'd be happy to take any testimony on it. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just maybe to clarify the reasons for this. Part of the reason for this bill was concerns that maybe the imaging centers and the other carve-outs were not doing sort of their social duty in terms of serving public assistance programs, including workers' comp. So this is a way to track and make sure that continues to happen. That's as I understood it.
Representative Segrin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Boudreau. On your First Amendment that you had that we passed on in regard to adverse reporting of adverse
events,
does that piece of legislation or that amendment that's going in here, does that now affect the standalone clinics too? Is that why this is in here? Is this a different issue that is needed to be amended along with this?
Representative Boudreau.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Segrin, yes. The adverse event reporting will now be something that's reported by outpatient clinics as well as imaging centers. And that is about medical errors that essentially is related to medical errors and how the whole purpose of the reporting system is how to discuss with medical professionals and providers how to avoid such a future error to occur. It's a recent system. We're like first in the nation to do this. It's something that I think we should take great pride in doing.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and members, to follow up on Representative Bradley, the reason this is in here is that one of the allegations that's been made is that the imaging centers and the surgery centers are not treating public patients because they don't pay as much. So, and this is an allegation, I don't think it's true, but the allegation was that they would then, if a surgeon, let's say, had a patient, he would refer him to the surgery center where he could charge a higher rate than if the person was on medical assistance or Minnesota Care or whatnot, and then they would send the Minnesota Care or the medical assistance patients to the hospital and let the hospital eat the low reimbursement rate that we pay for those programs. I don't think that's true, but that was the allegation, and the intent here is for the public to understand if they are steering patients to different places, depending on what the payment source is.
Well, Mr.
Representative Solberg.
I understand that the basis between private pay and public pay, but give me the rationale for workers' comp being tracked separately.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Huntley,
Representative Solberg, I assume they just added that because those are the things that these imaging centers do. But we never, I don't think, discussed workers' comp when we heard this.
Representative Solberg,
that might be a huge change in policy, and I don't know as if I have any expertise or even any thoughts on policy here. But we are having an amendment that it does have some far-reaching effects other than just some gathering of data, I think. And I guess I would like to have, I could understand the explanation for private pay to public pay if they're not taking their social conscience in. But I guess I would like to have some justification for tracking from the department why workers' comp would be tracked separately. Isn't that part of the private pay?
Representative Boudreau.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, actually it is part of the public pay program, and that is why it's included. And I believe that there may be different rates. I don't know. I don't know exactly, but I'm sure that could play into that. I think it's all about just trying to categorize the referrals and who's referred and how, you know, to get some clarification as to who actually is being served. I think Representative Huntley termed it pretty adequately that we really don't know. And so,
Representative Huntley explained two parts of it, but not the third, and he wasn't able to explain the third. And I can understand
He's
that.
Good. He's pretty good.
Two out of three is pretty good, but maybe someone from the Medical Association, since this is coming from the Department of Health, I think, has tried to... we have at least somebody from somebody say something good or bad? You don't mind?
What would you like, good or bad?
Mr. Renner, welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Mr. Chair, members, Dave Renner with the Minnesota Medical Association. As my understanding, the question is why we're separating out in workers' comp as a separate payer. My understanding, this is again in the negotiations with the hospital association, including a number of the imaging facilities and the surgical facilities. Their interest was to as I think Representative Huntley and Representative Bradley had expressed, to get a handle on where payers are going, which mix of patients these facilities are serving. Workers' compensation, when you compare it to some of the other payers, is a higher fee schedule than some of the other payers, and some felt that it would be inappropriate for some of these facilities only to take workers' comp and not to take other public programs like medical assistance, MA, which or GAMC and Minnesota Care, which are extremely low payers.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, thank
Representative Solberg.
Thank you for the explanation.
Mr. Renner, as long as I've got you up there, I just want to make sure. So I understand, since this was a controversial bill and since this is a change to the bill, though it may not be a large change, it's your understanding that the imaging centers, the surgical centers, the Minnesota Medical Association, and other doctors all support this amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, yes. This language, we did work with the Hospital Association. We have shared this with the lobbyists representing the surgical centers and the imaging facilities. I can't speak for them, but what they have all told me is that they think this is in line with the agreement that we had come with earlier, and this just gives more clarifying language, and they are all okay with this language.
Thank you. Any other discussion to the A9 amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the A9 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A9 amendment is adopted. Members, next I've been told that there is another technical amendment that we may need to put in and that we're going to, that I will move to make sure that we have all our bases covered. And I'm going to read it. If people want me to make copies, I can. But it would be page 17 after line 5. Insert the subsection 18 appropriations and the following language. Any money received by the Department of Health from non-state sources to operate the outpatient surgical center reporting system in fiscal year 2005 are appropriated to the Department of Health for that purpose. Members, if you want me to, I can go ahead and print that off. It's kind of a long amendment, but if you're comfortable with that being an oral amendment, we can go forward. I'll move that amendment. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
That sounds reasonable to me. You're actually back to your concept of a few years ago where a fee actually is for a service and goes to that.
Just making sure everything works in the bill, Representative Rukavina. Any other discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the Knobloch oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The oral amendment is adopted. Now, members, discussion to the bill. Any other discussion to the bill as amended?
Well,
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair and Representative Boudreau, usually when, you know, you have a bill and a bill that had a real noble cause, you know, when you first introduced it, and now everybody's agreeing on everything, usually I find when everybody agrees on everything, you really don't accomplish anything. So did you accomplish anything in what you first set out to do with this bill?
Oh, that hurts.
Representative Boudreau, do you want to respond to that?
I think Representative Boudreau would agree with me on that thing.
Representative Boudreau.
And Representative Rukavina, obviously some bills take a lot more work than others, and I think this is a great bill, especially in the fact that people have changed positions dramatically, I think, from the original language, in that there's a willingness for us to, what do you want to say, let the sun shine on referrals, let the sun shine on payers, on the information about where the services are being provided and where the dollars are being paid. And I think that's helpful to consumers and helpful to people who need care. And so I think it's a good thing.
I trust them. I think it's a great thing. Thanks for asking.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rubino, I would second what Representative Bujold has said. A lot of us probably were caught in what was a war for a while. And I think this is probably an example of the legislative process, thanks to Representative Bujold's skill, and also the negotiation process and better balance between the parties. And the end product, when you read the bill carefully, what you do see is that the end product does make a difference. It is different than today. It does provide some better balance between our hospitals, and these are what we're trying to protect in some respects. I think this was the original motivation of the bill, is to protect hospitals from, let's say, carve-outs that would be unfair carve-outs, where people can build profit centers and those kinds of things, and our hospitals that have to provide full service can't make a living then. On the other hand, we don't want to put out of business those that can provide low-cost, high-quality services like imaging. And the end product, frankly, I think is a really good balance that does provide some protection, but also lets the industry continue to provide services to patients. So I think Representative Bujold and the parties involved particularly are to be congratulated. It's nice to see they can actually stand close to each other. They can talk to each other these days, and it's good to see.
Any other discussion to the bill? Representative Carlson.
Unless I misunderstood the comment by the author, I was trying to figure out why workers' comp would be considered a public expenditure. I thought I heard you say that.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me try that. I've kind of forgotten, and Representative Bradley, if I've got this wrong, correct me, but I think we sort of characterized what the problem was, but in fact, if you look at the original language, the utilization data tracking wasn't unique just to the public programs. It was really for all programs, and I think the new language just clarifies by saying health plans, public programs, and I'm not sure it should say including, but the services, if you looked at all the services that the imaging places do, would also include, of course, anybody who happens to be using workers' compensation services. So I think we may have created the image that all we were tracking were public programs. It's not. It's actually tracking all utilization. And Representative, is that correct in your recollection?
Representative Bedreau.
Mr. Chairman, I think it is close enough. You know, Representative Bradley, it wasn't my amendment. It's just all developed so recently. I think, but your point is, we want to assure that we have all the data of all the people that are treated and cared for, not just limited to certain areas. So I think it encompasses all of those patients.
Representative Carlson.
I understood the tracking part of it, but the reference was to workers' comp being a public expenditure. It's a different question than tracking as an expenditure. Yeah. The source of the money, everyone's required to carry workers' comp insurance, but payment is actually made by private insurance companies, and therefore it's not a public expenditure, and that's why I was asking. I thought maybe you had misstated the...
Mr. Chairman, I have one more witness that would like to weigh in.
Welcome to the committee. Could you give us your name and your testimony?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Sue Stout. I represent the Minnesota Nurses Association. And oftentimes when we talk about workers' comp, because of the fact that it's so regulated, you know, in the state, that we talk about it as a public program, but it's really not. I think that we sort of speak of it incorrectly at times. And in the healthcare world, we think of it as public dollars because it's so regulated by the public. The fee schedules are regulated, and so we kind of think of it as public dollars. And we also, I think it's the Rule 110, I believe it is, 101, that kind of includes that in one of the good payment sources that you have to you have to serve everybody in order to get that book of business. So that's what makes us put it in our minds in that category, but it really technically is not public money.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
At that point, and I think why Representative Solberg was asking too, is you get a little, you know, paranoid, and Representative Carlson realizes he's been around here a long time about, you know, what I'm seeing is they'll categorize it and then say, okay, a few years from now that they charge so much more for an MRI for a workers' comp injury than what Blue Cross and Blue Shield is paying for the standard practice. So that'll be the justification for cutting it, you know. We used to, the joke was, you know, if you get hurt off the job, crawl to work so you can get workers' comp. Now, after the 95 bill, it's crawl home so you don't have to file a workers' comp claim because of the way you get treated when you get hurt on the job. So I understand where you're both questioning it, because I get a little paranoid too when I see that singled out.
Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of House File 2127 as amended being recommended to pass and referred to the General Register, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, committee members.
Thank you, Representative Boudreau. Okay, next we'll take up House File 1798.
Didn't we kill this bill once? Paul, you going to pass this bill this time or what?
Which one did you do? 1798. Chair will move that House File 1798 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Yeah. Members, we had temporarily laid over this bill last week because there were some questions that came up from a number of members, and we're bringing it back now, hoping that we have addressed some of those. Representative Coles, Mr. Black, welcome back to the committee. Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for letting me come back. I had so much fun last week. I was really been looking forward to joining you this afternoon.
You want to come back again?
Well, we'll see, Mr. Chair. Do I want to? No, and I hope I don't have to. Mr. Chair and members, the page is distributing the A8, or actually a modified A8 amendment with some handwriting on it. There were some further discussions even after I entered the room and after the meeting started. And a desire for some additional comfort language regarding the effect of an administrative dissolution. And that's what the handwritten language on the A8 amendment is intended to provide. What the amendment does, as you'll recall from last week, one of the primary concerns that some of the members of the committee discussed was that the bill, as introduced and as before the committee last week, mandated electronic filing of the annual registration form for corporations. The A8 amendment indicates that the Secretary's office will mail a postcard to the registered entity informing them that they must file an annual registration, and that the the filing can be done either electronically or by paper. And the postcard now, with the addition of the handwritten language on the amendment, will also inform the entity that failure to file the annual registration will result in an administrative dissolution or termination of the entity. Mr. Chair and members, I think that resolves the issues that were raised last week, and certainly stand for any questions that the committee members may have.
Okay, the chair will move the H1798A8 amendment with the handwritten additions. Any discussion to the A8 amendment? Representative Solberg.
Have you reviewed this then, and or is this the issue that Representative Krinke had concern about, postcard?
Well, Representative Solberg, maybe I should let Mr. Black answer. Mr. Black, Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair and Representative Solberg, I have discussed this with Representative Krinke. He's indicated that this is acceptable to him, and his concerns are addressed by this amendment.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Solberg.
Point of clarification, and I see in our packet we had the A5 amendment was adopted last time. That deals with postcards, too. Is this one being still in part of the bill?
Representative Solberg, I would say yes, it is still in the bill because we had passed that amendment. We've taken the bill up again, and so that previous A5 amendment is part of the 1798 that's before us now.
Okay.
Other discussion to the A8 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the A8 amendment with the handwriting, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A8 amendment is adopted. Members, to the House File 1798 is amended. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Solberg.
There was another big concern about this issue, and that was whether or not, did we do that one?
Oh, Representative Solberg, if you're talking about the online filing issue.
Yes.
Yes, that is in the A8 amendment. If you look at page 1, line 10, where it says page 2, delete lines 33 and 34, okay. That takes out the requirement. And I had looked through this amendment earlier, and there's a few other references in here where it strikes similar language.
And so that concern has been addressed as well, Mr. Chair.
I believe it has, Representative Solberg.
Then I have one other question. I see in the fiscal note something that's a little bit strange. In the fiscal note, in the first page, it said it is recommended that Section 23 of the bill be deleted. Changes to agency budgets due to legislative action are implied under the bill in MS 15.039. It may be comfort language for somebody, but I think this is an automatic type of thing, and I'm questioning why this base adjustment would not be just taken care of under the normal budgeting process that takes place every biennium. And if we have a recommendation from finance that it be deleted, I would think that we should take their recommendation.
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chairman, I am Bert, and Representative Solberg. I'm Bert Black, business and legal analyst for the Office of the Secretary of State. And number one, the reason for this language is to ensure, particularly as between different agencies that are under the purview of the governor and ourselves as a different constitutional office, we wanted to make sure that information was in the Department of Finance language. We've had occasions in the past where there have been questions about base budgets, and so we wanted to make sure that there was absolutely no question that this is all relating to the cost of the transfer of the notary, which should be a wash. It's going to be the same money, whether it's with the Department of Commerce or with us, but the constitutional officers are sometimes put in a special position, and so we wanted to make sure that the Department of Finance understood that they needed to make that calculation. And so that I guess, Representative Solberg, is comfort language for the Office of the Secretary of State.
But Mr. Chairman, I'm not familiar with MS 15.039, but maybe I could ask legal counsel or Bill Marks or someone to see if we really need this, or if it's taken care of automatically under state law.
Mr. Chairman and
Mr. Black
and Representative Solberg, one more item, which is, of course, that in many sections in Chapter 15 refer to state agencies, and as a defined term, the Office of Secretary of State is not a state agency. So I'm not sure that the automatic nature of that would totally apply to the transfer.
Mr. Marks or Ms. Novak, do you want to speak to Representative Solberg's question?
Mr. Chair and Representative Solberg, 15.039 deals with, it's a general section dealing with when functions are transferred from one agency to another in legislation, and it essentially transfers the responsibilities, it transfers personnel, it transfers any unexpended funds, it transfers any future revenues and so on. It doesn't explicitly address the base adjustment issue. That is something that the Department of Finance would, as in past practice anyway, would deal with. Mr. Black is correct. It does refer to state agencies, so if under some definition the Secretary of State is not a state agency, I suppose that would be a question mark. I guess I would say that the Department of Finance would usually, in my experience, has made these base adjustments without the language being in the bill, but I also don't know if the language causes any particular problem. I would say it's probably not necessary, but it probably doesn't cause a problem either.
Representative Solberg.
Maybe, Mr. Marks, have you ever seen this kind of language in other things between, let's say, when we dealt with the Secretary or the Treasurer and going to different agencies and the other way? Or through the Attorney General?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, I don't recall
Marks,
seeing this before.
Representative Marks.
Representative Solberg, Bill Marks.
It's okay. I agree with him. He should be there. He is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, I don't recall seeing this before, but I don't think we've transferred functions with constitutional officers very frequently, so it's probably not something that's come up very often.
And Mr. Chair, I just...
Representative Solberg.
On the fiscal note, that's something that we've never usually see before, the recommendation from Department of Finance for change. So.
Yeah, no, that is unusual. I will certainly admit that. At one point, I had been told that there was someone else who wanted to testify on this bill. Is there still someone that wishes to testify on this bill? Yes, sir. Could you come forward? Welcome to the committee, sir. Could you give us your name and your testimony?
My name is Don Dame, retired engineer from Woodbury. There's two concerns I have. I had lots of concerns, but 90% of them were addressed by Representative Coles. The two I have left is that what this bill is saying is that if a corporation is dissolved, and let's say like 3M or Ford Motor Company, if the state chooses to dissolve it, these corporations will have no notice that they have been dissolved. I thought the way it is now, but I understand that a year or two ago it was changed. Previously, when the state dissolved a corporation for a failure to file these annual returns, after they were dissolved, they got a letter from the state saying you have been dissolved, and I think it said you have 60 days to file the paperwork and get reinstated. That paperwork is no longer going to be issued. So a company like 3M or Medtronic or Ford Motor can be dissolved, you know, if there's a glitch in the paperwork, and they'll never know that this dissolution of the corporation occurred. Representative Coles attempted to address it with this written modification to the amendment, and I think it does, you know, it's better than nothing, but what this says, it will be a notice to a corporation on a postcard mixed in with some other language that if they don't do something a year hence, you know, a year in the future, they'll be dissolved. I don't know if that language is strong enough. It's better than nothing, but I guess I would prefer to do it the way the state did previously. And after a company or a corporation was actually dissolved, the state sent a letter saying you've been dissolved. And if you want to, you better do something about it. The second issue I have, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't know if this can be solved by a legislative committee. What this says, if a company is dissolved, it's possible for two separate companies to both lay claim to the same name. And as an example, I'll say like the Dayton store. They no longer call it Dayton's. Presumably, if a little store on Rice Street wanted to call itself Dayton, they could go into the Secretary of State, pay $150, and they could take over the Dayton name. What the language in the bill says is that the original Dayton, if they pay $25, they could get the Dayton name back, and I don't think there's any time limit. Presumably, 30 years from now, Dayton can go back and say, I want that Dayton name back, and you know, then there's a legal fight between the new Dayton and the old Dayton. And my concern is that whoever has the most money for lawyers will prevail, and the little guy will get the shaft. And I guess that's the way it always works in this life. I don't know if the legislature can address the issue, but at least I wanted to make you aware that there is a conflict in the law where two people have a legal right to the same name. And instead of the legislature deciding who should get it, I guess it's up to who has the most money for lawyers. That's all I have.
Well, Mr. Dame, we appreciate you coming forward and giving us your testimony. Any questions for Mr. Dame? Otherwise, I think we'll have Mr. Black come forward. Thank you, Mr. Dame. Mr. Black, can you respond, or Representative Coles, to the points made by Mr. Dame?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Let me start with the last point that Mr. Dame made. And I would contend, Mr. Chair and members, that this bill actually improves the current state of the law. Currently, there is no process for reinstating a business entity after it has been administratively dissolved. This bill allows for an entity after an administrative dissolution or termination to become reinstated. The name issue is an issue that exists under current law. If a store on Rice Street today would try to If the Dayton name is available, I doubt that it is, but if it is available and would try to go forward and take that Dayton name, they would have the ability to do that subject to the potential of being sued by Dayton's or Marshall Fields for trademark infringement or whatever. This bill actually improves the situation, I believe, that Mr. Dame is concerned about with regard to the name issue. The first... The notice of dissolution, that's current law right now. There is no notice provided to a company after it's administratively dissolved or terminated. That's current law. This doesn't change that, but what this does with the handwritten text on the amendment is that it informs a business entity that if they don't file the required annual registration, that they will be dissolved. So I think that actually the amendment, the A8 amendment that we put on the bill, Mr. Chair and members, if it doesn't fully address Mr. Dame's concern, it goes a long way, and it is actually a step ahead of where we are with current law.
Well, Representative Coles, as I read the language, if you look to, say, page 3, paragraph, line 5, as I understand it, the way it works now, if you haven't filed for 3 consecutive years, you're dissolved, but then you're notified that you can be reinstated by paying $25 sometimes in the next year. Is that the way it is, Mr. Black?
Mr. Chairman, no, actually, currently the notice goes out a year ahead of time, and there is no actual notice at the current time, at the time of dissolution, and that's been in the law since 2000.
But you are notified that you... Are you notified right now before you are dissolved, or you are notified after you're dissolved?
You're notified a year before you're dissolved.
But after you have failed to file for some period of time?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And so you haven't been filing, a couple years go by, then you're notified.
Right. And then you have another year in which to file, and then at the end of that time, your dissolution would take effect.
Okay. Now you are, underneath the language you're proposing, you are sent a postcard each year saying you should file, and if you don't, you need to pay $25 if you're dissolved.
That is essentially correct, Mr. Chairman. You are required to file this calendar year. If you don't file, you'll be dissolved. And if you're dissolved, then you have to reinstate. That's correct.
Just out of curiosity, Mr. Black, so what? Just what is, you know, what's the reason behind making the change?
Mr. Chairman and members, all of the other business entities are currently at a one-year period of time. Actually, with the language of the A8, you'll notice we give business corporations 2 years before they are dissolved. But we are trying to move towards a more uniform system for each business entity so that no particular entity has an advantage one way or the other.
Representative Rukavina.
It wasn't on this particular issue. Is that okay, Mr. Chair?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I was... You know, I'm just curious, getting back to, and I see Mr. Marx is gone, but the issue that Representative Solberg was raising on Section 23, and so the Secretary of State's office is still going to be doing this, and that's put in statute that it's part of their budget? To clarify that they're still doing this and it should be in their base budget, or did they give up a function for which they are not going to be doing anything and which shouldn't be in their base budget, and but they want it in law that that'll be kept in their budget? I didn't follow that questioning.
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Rukavina, actually the opposite. We are going to be taking a function from the Department of Commerce, the function of registering notary publics in this state. And we simply want language in there that indicates that the funds which are currently have currently been appropriated to the Department of Commerce By the way, that's effective at the end of this biennium, simply because doing this in the middle of a biennium is just a big mess. But we want to make sure that in the base budgets, which are being starting to be prepared right now for the 06-07, that we get, that's correct, that we would be given the funding to do this function, which we're taking over.
Then, Mr. Chair,
Representative Rukavina.
For Representative Coles or Mr. Black, what kind of, what's the actual dollar amount of fees that are raised in this bill?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Rukavina, the fiscal note, I think it's 500, the fees to the general, which all go to the general fund, are currently collected by the Department of Commerce. They will, if this legislation is passed in the next biennium, they will be collected by Secretary of State's office, but will still go to the general fund, and that's in excess of, $582,000. The actual costs, which the Department of Commerce has indicated, and that's the base budget, presumably a further analysis will be done by the Department of Finance, but Commerce has indicated that it's a cost of about $45,000 a year.
Mr. Black, going back to the questions I had, so a corporation is dissolved. You send them notice saying that you may be reinstated by filing a fee of $25. How long is that good for? Does that say somewhere in the bill? I mean, is it good for 3 months, 6 months, a year, unlimited?
Right. Mr. Chairman, the current, actually the if you look at the current law of that section, if you miss 3 years, that's when we send you the postcard. You are still in existence at that point. Another year, and the postcard says you have to do something. If you don't do that, you are dissolved at the end of the fourth year. And so at that point, under current law, there is no reinstatement at all. The bill as proposed and as before you would allow for reinstatement at any later time. And actually, that's a concept that the Bar Association has commented to me on. They greatly desire the ability to reinstate these businesses at any later time because the inability to do that creates tremendous tax, intellectual problem, property, licensing, and real property issues for them. So they like the idea of being able to reinstate at any later time, and that is part of this proposal.
But presumably, if you are, you know, the Dayton's name, as we talked about earlier, and it lapses for 3 months and someone else comes along, it sounds like, would you register them as Dayton's if the Dayton name lapsed and someone on Rice Street showed up and wanted to be Dayton's on Rice?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that if you look at the bottom of page 3, lines 36, and then over to the top of page 4, I actually had this conversation with my friend, Mr. Dame, if the Dayton's name lapsed and they were dissolved, and some other entity were to come in and file under that name, if the Dayton's entity, the first filed entity, were to come in, they would reinstate, but they would have to choose another name for registration. Now, the way that it usually works, and any trademark lawyer will tell you this, is usually the big company sends the letter, which says cease and desist, even though our registration lapsed, we never stopped using it, we have a right to the trademark, our lawyers will be in touch with you. And after that, it's a matter between the private parties. And frankly, Mr. Chairman, it has been throughout Anglo-American civil law history. This starts to get into a big intellectual property discussion, which I don't want to go there, but that would be a private matter between the parties. But we as the Secretary of State's office, would not let them back in simply under their old name if somebody else had filed that name in the interim.
Other discussion of the bill? Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of House File 1798 as amended, being recommended to pass and referred to the General Register, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members.
Finally, final bill on the agenda, we have Representative Haas with House File 2629.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that bill.
Representative Haas moves that House File 2629 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
Thank
and
you,
Representative
Chair.
Haas, we have at least one amendment that I know about, the A5 amendment, which is your amendment. Representative Haas moves the A5 amendment. Can you tell us about that amendment, Representative Haas?
Let me see here, Mr. Chair. That was not my amendment.
All right. Well, then it's my amendment.
Okay.
I'll move the A5
okay,
amendment. Well, I think, Representative Haas, you and I have talked about this amendment, and I think, do you want to speak to it, Representative Haas, or should I?
Mr. Chair, why don't I go through the bill, and then I can explain it, and then we can do the amendment. I think that might be best. That'll put it in perspective.
Okay, I'll withdraw the motion on the A5 amendment. Representative Haas, tell us about House File 2629.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2629, first of all, transfers the responsibilities for the Office of Strategic and Long-Range Planning and to the Department of Administration. And there's a lot of technical cleanup where they're just changing the responsibilities to the Department of Administration and to the Commissioner of Administration. The next section, Article 2, deals with energy forward pricing. Basically, what we're doing is we're going to go out to the futures market and buy energy needs into the future at lower prices. It's no different than if you live up in northern Minnesota or in rural areas or you have a lake home. You can buy your energy needs early in the year. I know with our particular situation, we buy gas for our lake home in the summertime because it's lower priced. And that locks in our price, and that's basically what the state is looking at doing with their purchase of energy needs. We reinstate the Small Business Procurement Council, and then the last piece, which this amendment deals with, is the Technology Enterprise Fund. And remember, this was a fund that was set up to coordinate the technical needs of the state agencies. This board was eliminated a couple years ago, and we're looking at reinstating it. And what this amendment that Representative Knobloch has does not reinstate the board, but takes the appropriations that's there because the Board of Nursing needs the money to complete the technology upgrades that they've been working on. And in order to complete it, they need this money. So if we delete the section, we get rid of the Technological Enterprise Fund, but with the amendment, we allow the transfer of the money to the Board of Nursing for those technological upgrades. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'll stand for questions, or if you want to do your amendment.
Okay, well, I'll move the A5 amendment. Just Representative Solberg. Sorry, I thought there was a tech. Did you have a question or a comment, Representative Solberg?
Yeah, I do. Maybe we can have a little bit of explanation of how the Technology Enterprise Fund in this bill it ties in with, I think, the State Department's bill that was passed. Was it not in that bill?
Well, here, Representative Solberg, in regard to the A5 amendment, what this basically does is we've seen this in the form of a bill earlier.
Yeah, I know that.
And we're basically just doing that. The Technology Enterprise Fund was eliminated in the 2003 state government bill, and this bill, as it is now, 2629, was proposing to reinstate it. And I guess I questioned whether we needed to do that or not since we had gotten rid of it, but we definitely need to do at least what is in the A5 amendment if we're not going to reinstate the fund. And so I guess it's for that purpose that I'm moving the A5 amendment. But it's certainly an item of discussion as to whether we should bring back the Technology Enterprise Fund in its entirety or not. And I don't know, Representative Haas, do you want to speak to that?
Oh, Mr. Chair, someone from the department is here to address that.
Okay.
This one here, yeah.
Welcome to the committee. Could you give us your name and give us your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Keith Payden. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Administration, also the Chief Information Officer for the state.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Payden.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, the TEP fund is a fund that we are asking to be reinstated for somewhat, or actually a very significantly different purpose. The original TEP fund was created to support innovation projects. We are asking for the TEP fund to be reinstated to help us potentially in the future as a funding vehicle, a management vehicle for enterprise cross-agency endeavors. We view it as a very important tool for us going forward as we start to drive some changes and try to establish some leverage in our information technology endeavors in the years to come.
Representative Krenke.
Thank you, members. The reason that the Technology Enterprise Fund was created to start with was my fault. I admit to my mistakes, Chairman and committee members, that I was lobbied heavily by the Department of Administration in 2001 to set up the slush fund. We conceded to the Department of Administration's desire to set this up. We went around and around about what dollars could be deposited in this fund. In 2003, I think we saw the error of our ways. We got rid of it, and to reinstate it is just as you can see on page 37 of the bill. To say that savings generated by information technology, communications project purchases, rebates, refunds, discounts, savings generated from aggregated purchases of software, services, technology products, sets up a potentially who knows what kind of slush fund at the department. If they're generating savings from these projects or getting refunds or the like, they should go back into the general fund. Then the legislature should make the decision as how those dollars should be appropriated. I don't think the Department of Administration needs this slush fund. So I would support the Knobloch A5 amendment.
Other discussion to the A5 amendment? Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, point of clarification, and I'm sorry I didn't get your name. I'm sorry.
Representative, my name is Keith Payton.
Mr. Payton, and you work for the Department of Administration, is that correct?
Yes, I do.
And you are testifying that the Department of Administration wants this fund?
Yes, sir, I am.
And can you tell me what the fund is used for other than the two projects that are started and not finished?
Mr. Payton.
The typical use of the fund.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the fund is purpose, as we see going forward, is to capture the savings that are accrued through many of our forward-looking activities, and to then potentially use that fund to generate more savings in the future. This language in the bill requires that the commissioner report to the legislature annually on the finances and activities related to the funds potentially funneled into it.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, are there any positions that are funded off of this fund? And if so, how many?
Mr. Payton.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, there are no positions that are funded off of this fund. It is a potential, however, that the fund could, with the savings, fund additional staffing, which would then in turn generate more savings. But at this time, the fund has zero balance, and there are no positions or any activities funded.
Mr. Payton, I'm sorry if I missed this, but say over the last biennium, or maybe the biennium previous to this one, how much money went into this fund and was spent out of this fund?
Mr. Chair, Representatives, I do not know. I believe that the fund was appropriated by the legislature, and I'm not sure what the total amounts going in or distributed were. It was in a different form at that time and in a different form going forward as we see it.
Do you recall what it was as of the end of 2003, what the activity for that year was when we eliminated the fund? Or a Representative Haas, do you have that answer?
Mr. Chair, to your question as far as how much money was appropriated to the fund, it was $9.4 million. And the amount of money that is left in the fund is the $117,000, which is being requested to complete the Board of Nursing's project.
And Mr. Payden, if we did not adopt the A5 amendment, are there some dollars that you see from savings that are about to come into the fund that would pay for this $117,000, or where would the $117,000 come from?
Mr. Chair, representatives, these are really, as I understand it, two separate issues. The fund has already been dissolved as of 2003, is my understanding, and these funds, $117,000, are part of that $9.4 million which was appropriated into it. We are suggesting that we reinstate the fund with a zero balance after, in addition to the language that is included in the amendment.
Well, it seems, I guess it's, I'm surprised to find that it was $9.4 million. I mean, that seems like a lot. Representative Carlson.
Chairman, I wasn't quite done, but I...
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, no,
okay.
I didn't mind it. The reason I asked the question I did about physicians and so on, not too many years ago, we had some discussion in the Education Finance Committee about some of the rebates and so on that the Department of Administration was getting for communications, telephone lines, and so on, and we had a bit of a dispute going in terms of your contracting through administration and the desire by the colleges and universities to enter into contracts, and their argument was that they could save some money at the time, and Department of Administration was indicating that through their contracts, rebates, or whatever term you might use, they were funding certain positions in the Department of Administration. Am I on the wrong track here?
Mr. Chair,
am I thinking of something different? But when I read this language, when it talks about communication projects and or purchases, including rebates, refunds, discounts, you know, it
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think we are confusing some things. By your language, I would guess that the issue that you're speaking to is around the Intertech organization, which is a revolving fund organization which provides services to state agencies, charges back for those, and at times provides a rebate based upon overcharging errors back to the agencies. That's where I think perhaps that issue might have been.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, from his description, I think that probably fits, as I recall that discussion. I did have one other question. How much was transferred out last year?
Mr. Payden.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am not sure whether or not what the amount was last year.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Solberg.
Would someone have that knowledge of what was transferred out last year?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Haas.
You had a nod from admin. I don't think they had a number on that. Did you have a number? Okay. Yeah.
Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Larry Freund. I'm with the Department of Administration. That original $9,400,000 was appropriated in laws of 2001, and of that $9,400,000, $8,999,000 was specifically given to certain areas. Department of Revenue, they were projects that were in the law, and there was a balance left at the end. Some of that was, most of that went to these small agency projects and different things. Of that money that was remaining, the $407,000, all that's left is $117,000. So there's nothing's been transferred out or into that account other than that $9,400,000, which was a general fund appropriation.
Uh, Any other questions or discussion?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Solberg.
I think I'm coming down on the side of Representative Krinke and saying if it was an appropriation, then where was the savings? I thought that this fund was because of savings.
Representative Krinke. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, to give committee members a little bit additional background, as I recollect the discussions in 2001, the Department of Administration wanted to set up this technology enterprise fund. But what we did is we appropriated money into the fund for specific technology projects, i.e. the sales tax restructuring over at the Department of Revenue and numerous other projects that were quite expensive. This was to be an incentive type of plan so that if there was money, the project didn't cost as much as was originally estimated, that they could still remain in this fund to be used for other technology projects. The commissioner wanted to keep adding in other revenues from other sources to this fund. We limited it to a very few, and I don't think the quote-unquote incentive concept ever really was achieved, and therefore we decided, or the long and the short of how all that came about, was the repeal in 2003. I think Representative Haas could probably give a better recollection because he was chairing the committee at that point. So my concern is, A, let's not repeat the mistake I believe we made in 2001. And if anything, if there are savings, if any of the list of these items does occur with rebates, refunds, discounts, other savings, again, members, I just think that those dollars should go back to the general fund and we appropriate them out as we do many other dollars instead of this being some sort of a, it's not even a revolving fund. I mean, this just says that they're going to report back to the chairs of committee, not to the legislature, but report back to a couple of chairs how they expended the dollars. I think this is worse than it was even set up in 2001. So, members, as I said, my experience would tell me put the money in the general fund from savings and we'll appropriate it out as we see fit for technology projects.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, I want to go to the 117, and I understand that there may have been at least a little bit of discrepancies on whether or not that was committed funds before the fund was done away with. And normally that would, I would think, documents that would come forward to us starting the next fiscal year be canceled. But I think that there was at least, if not a legal obligation, some kind of a moral obligation on the part of the funds to finish the projects on 117. And I do think that the Department of Finance could have probably been more upfront with us on it and telling us earlier on so that this wouldn't have been in this particular difficulty right now. So I would support the expenditure of the 117, if not on a legal basis, I've encumbered the funds, at least on a moral basis of getting this done. And I think that does away with it.
Mr. Chair, just to
Representative Haas.
Representative Solberg's comment, LIMIC and the Board of Nursing's projects were underway at the time of cancellation. Mm-hmm. So that's why the need for the appropriation to finish up. And the Board of Nursing really needs it to get computerized for their needs.
Well, at this time, then, I'll renew my motion that the A5 amendment be adopted. All in favor of the A5 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A5 amendment is adopted. To the bill as amended. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, there's another amendment before us here in the packet.
Mr. Chair, can I offer the other amendment that nobody else does?
Representative Haas, the other amendments, it is my understanding that the person who was going to offer the other amendment is not going to offer the amendment, but if someone else wants to offer the amendment, of course, any amendment is in order.
Mr. Chair?
Well, I shouldn't say any amendment is in order, but at least
this one is.
This one probably is.
Well, Mr. Chair, it just looks like a good amendment, and you know, I was wondering who maybe was going to offer it and why they weren't. You're sheepishly raising your hand over there and blushing.
Mr. Chair, I was
Representative Quaisley.
Mr. Chair, I was going to offer that amendment, but I understood that the bill would then be referred to government or local government, which would kill the bill, so I'll wait and shoot arrows later.
Well, that sounds like a good enough explanation for me. I'm taking my
Representative Rooker, we were told that the chair of the local government committee felt he would need to see the bill if this amendment would go on. Representative Quaisley.
Mr. Chair, I'll gladly share my arrows with Representative Rooker when the time comes.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I take an arrow for Representative Quaisley.
Any other amendments?
Mr. Chair, if not,
second to the bill.
There's no discussion, Mr. Chair. I'll renew my motion.
Representative Haas renews his motion that House File 2629, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed. With that, members, we have no other bills before the committee. We are going to be having a meeting tentatively tomorrow afternoon, probably around 4 o'clock, to take up the tax bill. Watch for the notice that will be posted soon.
What time do we go into
session, I believe, is at noon. Any other questions?
Or is it going to be a long session tomorrow, Mr. Chairman? The speaker's sitting there. Maybe he knows.
Well, I don't believe the session will be real long. I don't know that the bill coming here will take a real long time either. But I think we have posted it for 4 o'clock. We have posted it for 4 o'clock.
Okay, very good.
Okay, seeing no further discussion, the meeting is adjourned.